Chapter 4. I dreamed the snow was you when there was snow. It's one thing for Ted to talk a big game in re-showing Trent off to other people, but he'll be the first to admit his follow-up could use a little work. "What the fuck did you do to yourself?" Trent demands a week and a half later, hovering in the doorway to Ted's bedroom. "You were going to wear your hair up for tonight?" says Ted, crestfallen. Trent makes a constipated noise and zooms off back toward the kitchen, his sneakers squeaking on the hardwood floor. Ted can't really blame him for being grumpy. They'd managed to get Ted's, Trent's, Beard's, and Higgins's schedules coordinated on Monday to meet up, only for Trent and Serafina to fall prey to a cold that took them both out of commission for a couple days. Tonight's supposed to be their makeup get-together. Ted texted everybody this morning with instructions. Higgins was good cop, Beard was silent cop, and Trent had to stay away from the Glenfiddich, and told them all to meet at the Crown and Anchor at 8. Then the 6:30 Vinyasa Yoga for Beginners class happened, and then a trip to the emergency room, which aren't called emergency rooms here, and then some very effective painkillers. Ted's not entirely sure how he got from the cab up to his apartment, but he does remember sending Trent a message explaining the situation once he'd gotten himself in bed and figured out how to plug in his phone. It's not until Trent comes back with a beer from the fridge to sit on the edge of the bed that Ted thinks to ask, "How'd you get in, anyway?" Not that he's objecting in any way, shape, or form. Especially form, since Trent's got such a nice one. Particularly when he drinks from a bottle like that. Makes a man think all sorts of things about that mouth. Trent coughs a little. "You are aware that you're saying all of that out loud, correct?" He puts the beer on the nightstand and picks up the bottle of pills Ted dumped there when he emptied his pockets before hopping into, and more or less landing on, the bed. "Oh, dear," he says as he reads it over. "Yes, sweetheart," Ted replies, cheered up that it only took breaking his ankle to move them into the pet name stage. He should go out and break his other ankle to make sure. Trent laughs for some reason and pulls off his shoes. "I seriously doubt it's broken," he says, while he takes off his jacket and tosses it over back of the armchair. He's not wearing a tie today, opting for his t-shirt under a button-down under a jacket look, but there's something about him that makes Ted feel like he's emotionally loosening his tie, or spiritually, or maybe sexually. Ted's flattered, but he's pretty sure he's not supposed to have sex with a broken ankle. "Well, in that case, I hope it isn't broken," says Trent, and climbs up next to Ted, all of him right there in reach. Ted reaches and gets Trent on top of him like a big pointy blanket. Trent tries rolling off again, but Ted took wrestling in high school, so Trent doesn't have a chance in hell. "We'll revisit that later," says Trent, wisely giving up the struggle. "But I'm absolutely not doing anything with you in this condition." "Can we do this, though?" Ted asks hopefully, smoothing his hands down Trent's back. "I like you here. You're just so long." Trent props himself up on his elbows so he can look down at Ted with one eyebrow all the way up. "Not like that," Ted huffs, and the other eyebrow takes off. "Okay, yeah, like that too, but I was meaning more that I really like your body. And you, as a person," he adds, because Trent shouldn't get the wrong idea here, "but also your body. That's how I broke my ankle. Did I tell you that? I was doing a tree pose, I think it's called, And I thought about you and I got all scrambled. And let me tell you what, being scrambled when you're trying to balance on one foot and put your other foot on your knee does not make for a good omelet. Trent frowns, and Ted gets fascinated by the lines bracketing his mouth. You injured yourself doing yoga? Says Trent, slapping his hand away. Ted puts his hand back on Trent's back. Yeah, Roy recommended it. Said it's good for shagging, which I have to tell you is an amazing word for sex. Although I keep thinking about that Shaggy Dog movie from the 70s, not sexy. But you are, and there's some poses that can help out with sex or shagging, especially once we get to anal sex, which I've been getting more on board with, I should tell you. I was kind of worried about butt stuff at first. You hear all sorts of things, and I didn't want to bring it up until you brought it up. But the last time we tried the old frittage cheese and we were getting all enthusiastic about it, you remember that? I do, says Trent, pretty evenly. But Ted's an observant fellow, and he can tell when Trent's trying not to laugh at him, which doesn't happen often. Trent's pretty comfortable laughing at him. Well, at one point your dick sort of slipped. I guess that's not the technical term. Is there a technical term for that? And you pushed right up against there, and I just about came so hard I blacked out, seeing stars and everything. So, I'll probably like it, or at least I hope I will, and I'm thinking we should try it sometime, but that's why I am taking some yoga to help for that, because I'll tell you, Trent, some of those positions in the textbook look advanced. Did you know there's one called pile driver? All right, that's enough of that, says Trent, and kisses him. It's a nice kiss, the one Trent gives him when he's being affectionate but doesn't want to admit it. It's Ted's favorite. I really need to burn this textbook of yours. What? He says, trying to remember what they were talking about. Trent brushes some of Ted's hair off his forehead, which is nice of him. Try to get some rest, Ted, he says. And that's the last thing Ted remembers for a few hours. He wakes up with cotton mouth and a throbbing ankle. Trent's sitting cross-legged on the bed next to him, tapping away on his phone. For a guy who still wanders around everywhere scribbling stuff down into a notebook, Trent's actually pretty fast with the thumb typing. Ted's seen him write up whole articles like that, hunched over with his glasses sliding down his nose every 5 seconds. Hey, he says, and manages to sit up and land a kiss on Trent's shoulder. What time is it? He remembers the yoga class in the hospital and most of his and Trent's chat from before, but there's a lot of holes, such as how Trent got in, for one thing. 9:30, says Trent, which means 9:30 in American. His hair's got that weird bend to it that it gets when he's had it pulled back for most of the day. Coach Beard has already been alerted that we wouldn't be coming out tonight and said he would let Higgins know. You've got Beard's number? Ted asks, surprised. I have now, Trent says, still typing. I sent him a message via Twitter, which fortunately he checks a great deal more often than you do, and we exchanged contact information in the event that you do grievous bodily injury to yourself again. I suppose I should have seen this coming, Ted muses, you two conspiring against me. I have not thus far been invited into the Diamond Dogs, so you needn't worry, says Trent, still frowning at his phone. He has it open to Twitter, so maybe he and Beard are working out a Ted-minding schedule. Probably wouldn't be the worst idea. I'm more worried how you managed to break into my apartment, says Ted. Although he's not, really. It seems like a handy skill to have. Besides, if he gets to wake up next to Trent on the regular, he'll happily deal with some light B&E. Fortunately, you've informed me multiple times that you keep a spare set of keys in the odd little decorative vase in the communal hallway, Trent says. He stops his thumbs whirling around for a second, looks hard at something on his phone, then pushes a button and tosses it on the nightstand before turning his full attention to Ted. By the way, I've confiscated that set. I don't care how much you like indiscreet, it's an appalling security risk. If you ever do lock yourself out, you'll just have to call me, as opposed to sending me an incomprehensible text. Since Ted has been repeatedly telling Trent about those keys in the hopes that the hint would be taken, he's too busy basking in victory to take umbrage at the tone. Well, clearly whatever incomprehensible text I sent still got you here, he says, and with one last shoulder kiss, he tries swinging his legs over to stand. The sprain's pretty bad, but he's had worse, and mostly he's just annoyed at himself for ruining their plans. Do you need help? Pretty sure brushing my teeth and seeing to nature are still things a man has to do for himself. Ted limp hops in what is no doubt a very attractive way to the bathroom. After he deals with his bladder and his teeth, he tries getting his hair to do something other than the patented lasso bedhead special of half flat, half mohawk. He gives up after a minute or two. Trent's already seen him. Not much point now. When he comes back out, Trent's made himself comfortable on the bed, sprawled out like he's Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park, though sadly he does still have his shirts on. Still, he doesn't look like he's got plans to go home anytime soon. "Hello again," says Ted, and shuts off the bathroom light. "I'd like to revisit some topics we discussed earlier this evening," says Trent, "if you've no objection." "I probably don't, but who knows," Ted says honestly, half crashing back onto the bed. "The hours between the hospital and about 5 minutes ago are a little blurry. Did I talk about high school wrestling?" "That's certainly a subject of interest," says Trent. And there's something exhilarating about the way he immediately turns on his side to put his hand under Ted's shirt, warm against his heart. "I'll bet." Ted gets his arm under Trent's head and gets him a little closer. Because it's Friday night, and neither of them have a game, and Serafina is at her grandparents' place until tomorrow morning. Sprained ankle or not, Ted likes the idea. "What else is a subject of interest?" Trent Krim from The Independent. "Earlier, you claimed to have broken your ankle doing yoga in the interests of having better sex," he says, scratching his fingers down along Ted's stomach. "Don't you worry that might send the wrong message, given that I've been reliably informed the other party has no intention of taking up said pastime?" Ted's not ticklish, but he still shivers. Which is good, because otherwise he'd be covering his face in embarrassment. Trent seems to enjoy that, though. "All right. First off, if the sex gets much better, I'll be going to the ER for a whole nother reason," he says, shifting so that he can grab one of the pillows under his head and stuff it under his calf. "Second, maybe you should try it. I sure would love seeing you in some of those yoga pants. Third, it was a sprain, nothing's broken. And fourth, it's not for better sex, it's more for, what's the word, preemptive planning. For future sex." "Future sex, I see. Such as?" Trent asks, all but batting his eyes as he runs the back of his fingers just under the waistband of Ted's boxers. Ted really hopes he isn't using this interview technique on anybody else, otherwise the whole country's state secrets will get turned right over. "All right, I'm a little hazy, but I'm pretty sure I told you what such as I was thinking about," he says, trying not to sound defensive. "Off the record, of course." Of course, says Trent. And now he stuck his hand right down Ted's boxers to give him some quick, hard pulls. Not that Ted's dick needed a lot of encouragement by now. He tries kicking his boxers off, but his ankle doesn't much like that, so Trent gets up to help out and gets Ted's t-shirt off, too. Then he stands there for a little bit, looking at Ted from the foot of the bed. Ted's mostly gotten over his issues as far as being naked with another man, but he can't help noticing Trent's still fully dressed. You care to join me there? No, Trent says. He takes his hair tie off his wrist and puts his hair back, then starts rolling up his sleeves. It's sexy and intimidating at the same time, which is pretty much Trent Crim in a nutshell. I'd like to try something else, if you don't mind. Experience indicates that I won't, so sure, says Ted, even though his hands are twitching with the desire to cover up with a blanket. Which is when Trent climbs right on top of him, clothes and all. Before I forget, there's something else we should discuss, he says, looking serious. You proposed sweetheart as a term of endearment, which I've no objection to. But have you any thoughts as to what you'd like me to call the you? Most of Ted's thoughts are focused on finding out what it is that Trent wants to try, but he drags what brain cells he can back to the question. There aren't a lot to spare. Not at present, but I'll get back to you. Excellent, Trent says, and kisses him again before moving downward in a very promising direction. He gets comfortable between Ted's legs, which has a whole lot of visual appeal. Ted sits up far enough to get more pillows behind him, making a couple adjustments so he's sure not to miss a thing. Trent props his head on his hand to wait for him to get done, his other one making idle patterns on Ted's thigh. Ready, he says, only making fun a little bit. There's a bottle of one of Trent's fancy lubes next to Ted's knee, and Trent's fingers leave a shiny streak where he's touching him. Now that I've got a front row seat, I'm all... And Ted never gets to finish his joke, because Trent takes the head of his cock right into his mouth. No big show about it, just swallowing him down, and all of a sudden Ted's world is pressure and pleasure and soft, wet warmth. Ted wants to watch every second, or maybe lay back and take it, or maybe push his hips up into Trent's beautiful, mean mouth. Fuck, he decides on, before remembering they have to keep it down for Miss Shipley's sake. He can feel Trent's slick fingers just behind his balls, stroking gently before circling around his hole. He twitches, his body caught between instincts, and Trent slides off with an absolutely filthy sound. Do you like this? He asks, his mouth, that mouth, Jesus, quirking up in a little smile while his fingers press a little, just a bit, just enough to drive Ted absolutely out of his mind. I don't like that you stopped, Ted says. He tries not to sound too whiny, but it's the cruelest thing Trent's ever done. And he's the one who asked Ted about the offside rule when he was less than a week into the job. I like it. I promise. Well, then, Trent says, and he puts his mouth back on Ted just as his finger slides in, easy as anything. Ted's got just enough time to clap his hand over his mouth before he comes right down Trent's throat. Trent is still watching him. Ted can't look away, but it doesn't save him because he can't see Trent pushing his finger in a little bit more until it's too late. Ted can't come again, but it's like his body won't listen, filling him up and flooding his brain, leaving it clean and empty and quiet. he comes back around to this plane of existence a few seconds later, Trent looking self-satisfied between his legs while he uses Ted's undershirt to clean off his hands. "Welcome back," he says, smiling. "Glad to be here," Ted says, still breathing heavily. He feels like Laura Dern, trying to get all the controls to his brain switched back on before he gets eaten by a raptor. "As am I," says Trent, and crawls back up the bed. "So, Coach Lasso," he says, settling down half over him, "any thoughts on the performances so far?" "Well, it was a quick first half, I'll have to admit, but I'm real hopeful we can make a comeback." Trent gives him his "you're amusing, but you haven't answered the question" look, so Ted takes another few seconds to actually think about it, sort out the endorphins from everything else. "It was kind of overwhelming, I'll be honest, but in a good way, like when you're eating really great ice cream and you get an ice cream headache, but you want to keep going." "Not the first time I've been compared to a migraine, but certainly the most flattering," says Trent. He's hard in his pants, though, so at least Ted was putting on a good show. "Can I try it?" Ted asks, their hands tangling together at Trent's belt. Is there a term for that? The rusty trombone? He knows that term's got something to do with the butt and the dick at the same time, but he's unclear on the specifics. He should check the index of his textbook, see if they've got it listed somewhere. "I'm certainly not calling you that," Trent huffs while he gets his pants and his briefs down. "But for now, I just want..." He shifts until he can push up against Ted, hips pressing him down into the mattress. "I need..." "Oh, I know what you need," Ted says. "Hold on." He wriggles over until he's on his stomach. He feels kind of silly, but the way he can hear Trent's breathing get a little faster is its own reward. Trent doesn't need any more encouragement than that. He lays on top of him, his cock hot and wet between Ted's thighs, the lube already making things nice and slick. "Oh," murmurs Trent. "Oh, that's..." He grabs onto Ted's shoulder to get leverage, his other hand smoothing down Ted's side. "That's..." "You take what you need, sweetheart," he says, thankful that Trent can't see him, grinning against the pillow. "Come on now." He's not getting hard again, but it's still working for him. Working just fine for him. The slide of Trent's cock, but also the grip of his fingers, the soft brush of his shirt, the warmth of his breath. Trent's not thinking about how to get him off or what he likes best. All he's thinking about is what he wants, and he wants Ted. After a few minutes, Trent tenses and comes with a low moan, that same one that features in a lot of Ted's daydreams these days. All of them, really. It's messy and slippery and apt to be sticky pretty soon, but neither of them try to move just yet. Instead, Ted closes his eyes and breathes in the smell of him, sweat and cologne and whatever fancy shampoo he uses. One of these days, Ted's going to have to figure out how to put into words this feeling he's got, this bewildered, grateful, terrified joy in his chest that he's never felt before, might not have ever felt, if Trent hadn't finally lost his cool and confessed his big gay feelings by calling Ted a penis on his own front stoop. Because Ted's never really been wanted before. Not really. Not like this. He's gotten affection and warmth and intimacy, and he returned them because he thought they were the whole of what you got. He loved Michelle with a stubborn panic that there could be any other way to love, and as usual, she'd been the smarter of the two of them, figuring it out first. But with Trent, with them together, that want just keeps building, an itch that you satisfy only to flare up again a few seconds later. Ted's not worried about affection and warmth and intimacy. Trent's long since stopped being able to fool him, and he knows what he's seeing when they look at each other. It's this, this here in this bed, that still surprises him every time. Ted has a sneaking suspicion, and always will. Eventually, Ted does try to get up. Trent complains about it, although he doesn't use actual words so much as make a disgruntled humming sound like an irritated bumblebee. "Fine, but you're the one with the messy clothes," Ted tells him, managing to roll over at least enough to get Trent tucked into his side. "Don't blame me when you're the one having to wait for the dryer to finish cycling at 3 a.m.
"I probably will," says Trent, getting his leg over Ted's thighs.
As long as it's all right with you that I'm here at 3 a.m. He doesn't quite put a question mark at the end of the sentence, but it's close.
"I suppose so." Ted makes a face like he's considering it, even as he pulls him in closer.
"You really like being on top of me that much?"
"Yes," Trent says. "I like being your big, pointy blanket."
Ted's ankle is mostly fine by the next morning, which means he gets to wake Trent up with coffee and a blowjob before he has to head to the clubhouse for game day. Trent in the morning is a whole different animal than the guy Ted usually sees, sleepy and about a half second behind events, but he's very appreciative.
"Which one did you appreciate more, though?" Ted has to ask, pulling on his track pants and rummaging around in the closet for his one clean Richmond hoodie. "The coffee or the blowjob?"
Trent takes a big drink of his coffee and doesn't answer.
"You are cruel and unusual," Ted informs him.
"So I hear," says Trent, and gets out of bed to kiss him on the cheek. "Run along now, darling. I'll be sure to lock up." Ted's halfway down the stairs before "darling" hits him right between the eyes, and he has to go back up there to express his approval. He ends up 10 minutes late to work. It's freezing cold for the game, but that seems to work in their favor, everybody on Richmond's team going double time. Sam and Danny are really working their Vulcan mind meld ability to know where the other one is, which gets them 2 goals, and then Sam gives Jamie an assist with a 3rd goal to clinch it. They're not going to be wearing BFF necklaces anytime soon, but Sharon's right. They don't need to be friends to be a team. It still breaks Ted's heart a little, though. Beard's the one to suggest that Trent join them at May's after the game.
"Might as well get us while the endorphins are going," he says, bland as a banana.
Higgins is in, so Ted sends Trent a message to see if he wants to stop by once Arsenal's game wraps up. They're on their way over before he gets an answer. "If May does a round for the Wags and includes me, I'm leaving immediately." Which seems like a fair condition, and Ted accepts. By the time they get to the bar, the crowd's thinned out and nobody's swarming them. But there's a bigger problem.
"Fellas?" asks Ted, spotting the 2 women in the corner booth waving at them.
"Did you invite Julie and Jane along?"
Higgins looks confused.
"I thought this was a group outing."
"I just thought it'd be funny," says Beard.
Ted's got enough time to text a warning before Trent arrives, but the rest of the night goes okay. Higgins and Julie are both won over pretty fast with the discovery that Trent has a daughter. Beard doesn't say much, but Jane works at the place that published Trent's last 2 books and is working with him on his next one,
which means they hate some of the same people. Ted tries running interference as best he can. But after about 20 minutes in, Julie says, "Ted, fancy a game of darts?"
"Oh, yes," says Jane, very bright and smiley, which makes Ted immediately suspicious.
Sure enough, Beard and Higgins declare their intention to stay put, staring at Trent. More specifically, Beard stares, and Higgins kind of hopefully smiles at him.
"I believe I'm supposed to remain here and be interviewed," says Trent, stealing Ted's still mostly full glass of beer.
"Oh, how the turntables," says Ted, which neither Higgins nor Trent seems to understand. "Didn't y'all get the office over here?" That seems to confuse things even more, but Julie and Jane drag Ted off to teach them how to play. They're both pretty good for beginners, and Ted uses his offhand to keep it fair, although he does almost get Baz right in the eyebrow once while he's trying to peer over the crowd and see how Trent's getting along.
"Leslie told me this was still on the down low," whispers Julie while Jane's taking her turn. "But I have to say, Ted, he's a bit of all right, isn't he? Lovely hair."
"I keep telling him he should be doing shampoo commercials," says Ted, wondering if this classifies as girl talk.
"One of those ones by a waterfall or something," Jane agrees, retrieving her darts. "Plus, he actually sends his drafts in on time. Hope he goes like a dredger for you, Ted."
Ted's not sure what that last thing means, but it seems positive, so he thanks her for the support. Julie gets surprisingly competitive once she understands the rules, so it's almost an hour until Ted can get back to the table. "How's everybody doing over here?" he asks, sliding in next to Trent. They all look like they're in one piece. Higgins looks pleased about something, and even Beard's got his arms crossed in a faintly approving way.
"I drink your beer," says Trent, but he's smiling while he says it.
"That's only fair," Ted says, smiling back, the whole right side of him warm and pressed up next to him.
"So, this was lovely," says Julie, prodding at her husband, "and we really should be going home, but it was so nice meeting you, Trent. We must do this another time."
"Oh, yes, absolutely, always nice when friends get together," Higgins says, and gives Ted possibly the most unsubtle of subtle thumbs up. Beard and Jane seem ready to go too, so they all head out to walk home or get a cab or, in the Higgins's case, walk back to the clubhouse to retrieve the car. Beard makes the quick chat face at Ted, so he leaves Trent and Jane to their intricate scheme of revenge against some editor who's done them both dirty.
"Well?" asks Ted, bouncing a little on his toes. Beard nods his head.
Ted gets it. "Nice callback." He takes a deep breath, and then another, looking over to where Trent and Jane are waving their hands at each other while they plot. "What did he say to win you over?"
"That you were playing right-handed," says Beard, and claps him on the shoulder. "Nice draft pick, coach."
"Thanks, coach," says Ted, and watches as Jane and Beard pair off, arm in arm. Trent's watching them too.
"That woman," he says as Ted walks over, "is one of the most terrifying people I've ever met."
"That's a real pot and kettle situation as far as Ted's concerned.
Didn't you once make Vinnie Jones cry?"
"I'm mildly impressed you know who Vinnie Jones is."
"Course,"
Ted says, trying to look as innocent and earnest as he possibly can. "I watched every episode of Gallivant."
Trent laughs, loud enough that passers-by glance over at them. "I absolutely should have seen that coming," he says, shaking his head.
"You absolutely should have." So? Asks Trent, looking up at him. And Ted could swear on a stack of Bibles that he's nervous.
Did I pass the test?
Oh, flying colors, said Ted. I knew you would. You're a charmer, Trent, I keep telling you. Could sweet-talk the pants off a preacher, though from what I hear in the news sometimes, that's not as difficult as it ought to be.
I can think of someone else's pants I'd like to remove, actually, says Trent, stepping just a little bit closer than the regulation-friendly distance Ted's been trying to keep in mind this whole night.
Really? Asks Ted. Anybody I know?
They catch a cab back to Trent's place, despite Ted's apartment being all of a block away. Ted's grateful, since the idea of walking that far without touching Trent has become absolutely detestable. They're prevented from getting too fresh with each other by the driver, who recognizes Ted from TV and starts peppering him with questions about Chicago.
Pretty sure you've been there more than I have, Ted whispers to Trent at one point.
But Trent just smiles and slides his hand up another inch on Ted's thigh.
Stop that, or I'll forget all the points I need to make to George here about deep dish pizza.
They make it out of the cab and up the stairs and into the house without incident. But Ted's hanging by a thread here, so he's not entirely responsible for picking Trent up and slamming him against the wall. Or, more accurately, he is responsible, but he doesn't regret it.
This is a new experience for me, Trent confesses, laughing, his head tilted back so Ted can bite at his neck right where those stupid ties won't cover. I don't think I realized you can do this.
With enough motivation, Ted says, and stretching. He keeps his hands tight on the backs of Trent's thighs, using the leverage to grind into him. He just wants so much, voracious for it, hungry, like he's been starved for years.
Maybe there is something... Oh, to this yoga after all, Trent gasps, his thighs tightening around Ted's waist and moving with him, pulling Ted's head back with a hand in his hair so he can look down at him. Ted whines, so close already, and Trent's smile is sharp as a knife.
Very good, darling, he says, low and purring.
All right, says Ted. To himself as much as to Trent. I'm not coming in my pants like this is junior prom. He sets Trent down carefully, already missing him now that he's a whole half foot away.
Coach Lasso, Trent says, grinning. Would you mind expanding?
I would, yes, get your butt upstairs, Ted says, and hustles him up into his bedroom, where he pushes Trent against the wall.
This is somewhat familiar, Trent murmurs, although he looks gratifyingly surprised when Ted gets to his knees.
I'm sure you didn't have any trouble keeping your hands to yourself all night, Ted tells him, but not getting to touch you was driving me crazy. So if you don't mind...
Trent looks down at him, eyes wide and dark.
I don't mind, he says, carting his hand through Ted's hair.
Good, Ted mutters, and yanks Trent's pants and underwear down and finally gets his mouth on him. Trent's hand drifts to the back of his neck, soothing, and Ted pushes in a little further, a little more, sweat and sex on his tongue, his harsh breaths through his nose the loudest thing he can hear.
It's still not enough. Ted pulls off and pushes Trent's clothes down the rest of the way, getting them off one leg so he can haul Trent's thigh over his shoulder. He's done this before with women, opened them up to his mouth and fingers, and a distant part of his brain is a little smug, knowing that it works just fine on guys, too, if the way Trent thumps his head on the wall is any indication.
Ted, he says after a minute,
his breathing fast but sounding as calm as ever. "I'm going to come down your throat." And he does, Ted swallowing around him, taking what he's given and wanting more. Ted pulls off and takes his first real breath in a while. His vision's a little swimmy, but fortunately his lungs remember how to breathe after a few seconds. He's so hard it hurts, but when he tries to get his belt undone, Trent disentangles himself and pulls him up. "Oh no," Trent says, walking him backward toward the bed. "I have plans for you." They're good plans. There's the plan about getting naked, which Ted approves of, then the plan of Trent kissing him while he jerks him off, which he really approves of, then the plan of fingering him in long, lazy thrusts, which he approves of most of all. "In the spirit of Rule 2," says Trent, pressing long fingers into him, "I should tell you that keeping my hands off of you all night was amongst the most difficult things I've ever done." "Well, Ted Pants, your hands are on me now." Trent smiles. "They are. Do you like it?" He slides out, then back in, a slow rocking that Ted can feel everywhere, like the rumbled prayers at church or the roar of the wind across the plains or the crashing hush of the sea. Ted arches his back and wonders if this is a kind of prayer, if there's a God out there who can hear him, if he cares at all. "I love," he says, and can't think of any other words. He wakes up disoriented, with the bedroom all turned around and shaped weird, until he realizes he's not at his apartment. Then he's disoriented because he's alone, the other side of the bed hardly warm at all. He finds his boxers and shirt and heads downstairs barefoot to see where his boyfriend's got to. Where he's got to is the little balcony off the kitchen, leaning over the railing. There's hot coffee in the French press, and Ted pours himself a cup with plenty of cream and sugar before opening the sliding doors and getting hit with the most god-awful smell. Trent shoots about a foot in the air and spills his coffee everywhere. "Shit," he says, furiously mashing out a cigarette on the railing. "Trent Krim, what on earth?" Ted waves away at the stink. "You're a smoker now?" Trent stares at him for a second, the smushed up evidence still in his hand. "I've really no idea how to answer that." Ted looks around until he spots the pack of cigarettes tucked into a little ledge above the door, half empty with a lighter kept inside, just like his friends used to do in high school. "These things'll kill you," he says, shaking it at Trent. "I have one cigarette in the morning. I'll take the risk," says Trent, making a grab for the pack. "You should be grateful. I used to smoke a pack a day until Serafina came along." "Oh, I'm grateful, all right." Ted lets him have it back, but sneaks a kiss in the meantime. Ugh, morning breath and coffee and nicotine, horrible combo, he says, and takes a drink of his own coffee to handle it. Although this does explain a lot in regards to your spookability. Trent glares at him. "My what?" Ted glares right back, because his boyfriend doesn't get to be huffy right now. "You're trying to tell me you're not as high-strung as a cat in a rocking chair factory? 4 years of nicotine withdrawal would give anybody the jumps, I suppose." "Very funny. Give me your coffee since you made me spill mine." "I'm sorry. I don't share beverages with smokers,"
nasty aftertaste. But he does make breakfast, while banishing Trent upstairs for a shower and some serious time with the toothbrush, and they have breakfast in bed, getting crumbs and coffee stains all over the sheets. Turns out, London's got a lot of Michelin-rated restaurants, dozens of the suckers, so Ted ends up making a list on his laptop so he can sort them easier. He takes some out of contention altogether. He doesn't care how many stars it's got, he's not going to Gordon Ramsay's place, and arranges the rest of them with a few different criteria, mostly based around if Trent likes eating that sort of food. Still, deciding on one is harder than Ted thought it would be. Part of him wants Trent to just pick something, but he also wants to be able to pick the restaurant Trent would have picked. So he's understandably having some difficulties. "You do know it's all right if you don't want to do this," Trent tells him, peering at him over his book. It's a drizzly Tuesday evening. Their schedules lined up weirdly this week, which means they've had most of the day to themselves. Actually, that's not true. Trent still got to finish his article about the recent spate of injuries on Arsenal's team, and Ted needs to review footage of last night's game. But instead, Trent proposed some shower sex when he first came over, which Ted was all for, until he found out why. "I am going to say on the record," Ted said as he waved around the box holding the Microlax Complete Wash Enema Kit, "that I have some reservations about this. I used one of these when I had a colonoscopy a few years ago, and I was not a fan." Trent just smiled and plucked it out of his hands. "Yes, but it may be useful to learn the fundamentals now, while we're still at the, shall we say, preliminary stages." "So is this some sort of very roundabout constructive criticism of my roundabout?" Ted asks, trying not to pout. "No, you've been remarkably tidy," Trent told him, which made Ted's eyebrows go all the way up. "And I don't expect it will be a regular event. But as I said, one should always have a firm grasp on the fundamentals." "I'll firmly grasp your fundamentals," Ted muttered. "Besides," Trent added brightly, completely ignoring him, "you may find you enjoy it. Plenty of people do, especially ones as enthusiastic as you've been." Ted scrubbed his face, feeling it hot and red under his hands. "All right, but this is highly embarrassing."
"I like you embarrassed," Trent pointed out, mild as milk.
Ted snatched the box back and glared at him. "Yes, I am aware of that, sweetheart." But a few minutes of embarrassment was worth it, for Trent crowding him into the shower stall afterward, getting three fingers inside him while he murmured damp praise along Ted's shoulder. Ted pressed his forehead against the tile and just felt it, breathing through the stretch and burn of it, not able to talk or even think until he came, Trent telling him how well he'd done, how beautifully he'd taken it. Now they're hanging out on the couch, Trent's icicle feet tucked under Ted's thigh, while he reads some book with a faded title Ted can't read from here. Ted scrolling through some of the reviews for a place called Dinner by Heston Blumenthal, which he feels might be a little on the nose for the name of a restaurant. "I do want to do this," he assures Trent, rubbing his bony ankle, sliding his hand up under the two big sweatpants Trent's wearing now so he can feel the rough, smooth hair on his calf. "I just don't get Yelp sometimes. This turkey here gave the place 1 star because it was raining. She was inside, but apparently the rain spoiled the ambiance." Trent looks at him over the tops of his glasses, and Ted folds like a cheap suit.
I mean, sure, I'm nervous about it, but it's not like I don't want to be seen with you.
I should hope not. I've been reliably informed that I'm a catch, Trent says, shutting his book with his finger holding the page.
Ted's thought about getting him some bookmarks, but Trent seems to prefer this, waving a book around at him while they talk.
But I meant the entire ordeal. It's not just the restaurant.
Ted always gets distracted by the way Trent says, restaurant, but this is a serious conversation.
Aren't you nervous? Ted asks. You didn't even want to do this before.
Because it was a bit early to be making public statements and all the rest of it, says Trent, wiggling his toes under Ted's legs.
It still is, if I'm brutally honest. It'll only be 2 months on Tuesday.
Ted frowns, because that's not right. It's been 2.5 months.
Ted, sighs Trent, I'm fairly sure America doesn't count days differently, and we only started seeing each other on the 10th of January.
Yeah, but you kissed me on December 22nd, Ted argues.
Trent blinks at him for a minute.
Leaving aside the fact that you kissed me, he says slowly, a smile spreading all over his face.
Do you mean to tell me that you think our relationship started then?
Well, wasn't kissing anybody else, Ted says primly, before remembering, wait, no, May really laid one on me New Year's Day after we won against Blackburn. I'll cop to that one.
Yes, but that interval was intended for you to make up your mind as to whether you wanted to kiss anyone else, Trent says, still looking incredulous.
Come on now, Ted scoffs, like I wasn't a sure thing.
Trent reopens his book, fingers fussing at the top of a page.
So I'm beginning to realize. But going back to our original topic, coming out is always difficult, regardless of circumstance. There's nothing wrong with having some doubts.
Did you ever have to do something like this? Ted asks.
Before?
Did I ever date a celebrity, do you mean? Trent asks, clearly tickled pink by the question.
No, thank God. You're a tremendous amount of trouble. And he makes a big deal about going back to his book.
Very funny, says Ted, and pokes him until he looks up again.
I mean, did you ever have to... What was it like, telling the world you were gay?
That's a clumsy term for it. But Trent just makes a considering noise to himself and shuts his book again.
I don't suppose I did, really, he says. I've been out for most of my life, certainly my entire professional career.
What about your parents? Ted asks, thinking about the tiny little woman and the big red-headed man in Trent's photos at his house, beaming away at their only son.
I imagine they knew before I did, Trent says with a sort of far-off smile, before he seems to think on it a little more.
Mainly they fretted about me being safe, since Mum was a doctor, and the early 90s were a dangerous time for gay men, on any number of levels.
And professionally? Because that's another stumper, as far as Ted's own personal journey goes. He knows exactly how bad it'd be if he were still coaching football, American football, back home, but here he's got no frame of reference.
Professionally, Trent makes a dissatisfied sound. I had it worse than many, better than most. I was driven, I was persistent, and I was bloody lucky.
on any number of levels, Ted agrees.
Speaking of family, says Trent, looking like he's trying to be delicate, of all things. Have you talked to your mum yet about it? Or your sister?
Rule number two, Ted reminds himself. No, he says, and doesn't have anything to follow that up with. Trent doesn't look mad or disappointed. He looks understanding, which almost makes it worse. There's a saying about friends being the family you choose, he says, which implies that family is often the friends you don't choose, if you follow my meaning.
I think so, says Ted. I might need a map to get there.
But Trent just wiggles his toes some more. I'll be waiting at the destination. Ted calls Katie first, mostly because she's the one most likely to pick up. Mama's had a cell phone for a few years now, but she hardly ever has it with her. But in the end, it doesn't matter, because she's over at Mama's anyway. Ted paces behind the couch, Trent still curled up there with his book, although his hands outstretched to brush Ted's every time he passes by.
Hello there, Theodore, Mama says when Katie puts them on speaker. Are you getting along all right?
Oh, sure, he says, turning to pace the length of the living room again. He wants to ask, what about you? Because that always leads to a nice 20-minute dialogue between Katie and Mama about their farm, their friends, Katie's kids and grandkids, and any interesting gossip in Cherokee County. Usually, Ted uses this time to fold laundry or clean up the kitchen, listening to his family argue about things so far away from his life now that he can hardly see them with a telescope. But he has an awful feeling that if he doesn't get this out now, it'll lodge in his throat and choke him. So, listen, he says, taking a deep breath. He stopped by the couch and fumbles for Trent's hand. I've got something to talk to y'all about. Or, somebody.
Oh, God, you're not getting back together with Michelle, are you? Says Mama. I know she's the mother of your child, Theodore, but I swear.
No, Mama, I'm not. I've met someone. Someone else, over here.
Trent's holding his hand. He can do this. His name's Trent Krim.
It's awkward and nerve-wracking, and neither of them say much in response. Ted can see them so clear, sitting at Mama's beat-up kitchen table that they were raised around, hands clenched around their coffee mugs as they stare at him. After a while, Mama says, quietly,
"All right, that's enough."
And Katie says they've got to go. He hangs up and circles around to put his phone down carefully on the kitchen table, because it'd be bad manners to put it through a wall. I should text Michelle, he says, shaking out the tingles in his hands. See if we can sit Henry down tonight. Trent tugs at him until he sits on the couch, practically on top of him.
You're not some gay Father Christmas, he points out, his chin on Ted's shoulder. You don't have to do all of this in one night.
Clearly, you haven't seen my Santa hat. There's a decent chance Henry doesn't really get the whole conversation, but he's polite enough when Ted introduces him to Trent over FaceTime that night. Hi, Trent, he says, waving at him. Do you play Minecraft? Do you want to see my tower I built for my horses?
Oui, je voudrais beaucoup le voir, says Trent, with a sly look at Ted.
Henry lights up like a Christmas tree. Vous parlez français? The next half hour is spent listening to Henry explain survival mode versus creative mode to Trent, speaking what sounds like pretty good French, although periodically he'll drop back into English to ask Ted for various dinosaur-themed skin packs. Trent chatters back,
Ted can't understand most of it, Duolingo notwithstanding, but he can recognize vague parental approving noises in most languages. Michelle gets on for the last few minutes and assures Ted that she was listening for most of the conversation and that he did very well.
"I'll buy him one of the dino packs and tell him it was from Trent," she whispers, taking the phone to another room while Henry's distracted by a runaway horse. Although he might not even need the bribe if he gets someone who can actually talk French with him, as opposed to whatever me and Ted try to say.
Hi, by the way," she adds, smiling her "nice to meet you" smile, which is when Ted remembers that both of them are in the picture, snuggled together like this.
"I'm Michelle."
"Pleasure to meet you," says Trent, sitting up straighter. Ted really didn't think through the ramifications of doing this via FaceTime. "Henry's a wonderful young man."
"He's a lot like his dad," she says, winking.
"Good job, you two. And congratulations." Between the emotional workout and the shower sex before that, they end up falling asleep on the couch like a couple of senior citizens. Ted wakes up with the dawn's early light shining right into his face. He stretches and feels for Trent next to him, only opening his eyes when he comes up empty. He finds Trent shuffling around in the kitchen, looking half asleep and rocking some truly hilarious bedhead. He's staring uncomprehendingly at the wall next to Ted's counters.
"I don't have my cigarettes here," he says, forlorn. "Or a balcony."
"I know, sweetheart," Ted tells him, and turns on the coffee maker. "I know." In the end, Ted turns to who he should have asked all along, Keeley and Rebecca.
"Okay, so," Keeley says, taking his laptop away from him and settling it on her lap, "you'll want somewhere not too close to either of your places, so if you need to flee the scene, you're not just leading them right back.
They'll probably have a stakeout at both places anyway, but the principle's sound," says Rebecca, leaning over the back of the sectional to peer at the list.
"Oh, not that one," she adds, pointing at something on the list, "or that one."
Keeley taps something on the keyboard, making a thoughtful face.
"Probably best if it's one with a..."
Rebecca nods as she sits down next to her.
"Right, you want the option."
"Exactly, but they shouldn't have the..."
"No, of course not."
Ted goes and gets himself a soda from downstairs. By the time he gets back, they've made a call.
"Helene DeRose at the Connet," says Rebecca, handing him his laptop back.
"Lots of big windows to be seen and photographed," Keeley continues as she snatches it back. She pulls up some pictures of a nice-looking restaurant with, as promised, really tall windows. "Good number of side exits if you need to escape. The staff's really discreet, so they're not going to, like, sell a list of what you ate to some tabloid. Plus, it's a hotel, so you can just get a room if you need to hide for a few hours. Or whatever," she adds with a broad wink. Rebecca's not looking nearly as thrilled.
"And you're certain you want to go ahead with this?" she asks. "It's not as though you have an obligation to him to go public. If this is something he's insisting on..."
"Trent's been the one dragging his feet, boss. One of these days, he's going to have to figure out how to get the two of them to stop thinking the other one is an evil demon from the underworld. But it's probably not happening today. This was all my idea. And if you need me coordinating anything for, I don't know, social media stuff or press..."
"Oh, we're at full bikini stage red at the moment," Keeley assures him, which necessitates a 5-minute digression as to what exactly the bikini alert system was and why it was called that. Ted never gets a satisfactory answer to that last part, but figures it's something like DEFCON 1. "But it's going to be fine. Horrible and total shit, obviously, but fine by normal UK tabloid standards."
"Great," says Ted, even though he's got no idea if it is, and looks through the menu at Helene DeRose. He's got a little knot in his belly.
Maybe because he's hungry? How's the food?
Rebecca gives him a long look, but all she says is, it's fine. For Mayfair, anyway.
If Ted's honest, he doesn't remember a whole lot about Helene Durose at all. The food's tasty enough, but he's too distracted to really appreciate it. Every time there's somebody passing by the window, he's braced for something. He's not even sure what. A paparazzi flashing a picture? Some tabloid journalist shouting questions through the glass? How is it supposed to work, exactly? They get about halfway through the main course when Trent sighs.
All right, bollocks to this, and stands up, buttoning his jacket. He's actually wearing a suit, dark gray pants and jacket with a white shirt and a dark red tie. He looks good, and Ted hasn't even told him that yet. Come along. What's the matter? But Ted knows. This was supposed to be a nice date. The thing he's been pestering Trent for all this time, and he's ruined it already. I'm sorry, I'll try. Come along, Trent insists, and holds out his hand. I intended for this to be a surprise, but I've procured a room at the hotel for tonight, and I fully intend to use it rather than watch you chew your own mustache off. He flags down their waiter, Hugh, as he passes by. Charge our dinner to the room, Crim 347. It probably shouldn't be hot when Trent gets all bossy like this, but Ted's a simple man. So you're not mad? Trent gives him a sideways look as he pulls Ted to his feet. I've asked myself that question almost every day for the past year, he says. But no, I'm not angry. Just a bit impatient. Impatient, in this context, sounds good. Even while he gets hopeful at the implications of impatient, he's got to admire Trent's talent at derailing Ted's tendency to spiral with promises of sex. Still, do you think we did, I don't know, enough? He asks as Trent leads them back out through the restaurant, into the foyer and toward the bank of elevators.
I certainly hope so, says Trent, pressing the up button. Though part of me does enjoy doing this in public, despite the consequences.
Doing what? Having a meal with a bunch of very tiny plates? Asks Ted, because that's the clearest memory he's got of the last hour.
Trent smiles fondly at him, the way he does when Ted said something so dumb it's cute, and pulls him in closer. They're holding hands, Ted realizes. We're holding hands the whole time.
This, says Trent, and kisses him softly as the elevator pings.
I do hope you've kept up with your yoga, Trent teases, as he fingers Ted open, braced above him. The hotel room is probably really nice, but once again Ted's been distracted from appreciating it, although this is a much better distraction. Ted wants to make a smart-assed comment back, but something about this switches his brain right off, which he kind of likes. He can let the world narrow down to Trent's fingers, his voice.
Please, he manages. Please, please, please.
Shh. Yes, says Trent. And then he's in between Ted's legs where he belongs. He puts one hand on Ted's hip and fists his other in Ted's hair, holding him down and open for him, and all Ted can think is please, as Trent pushes in, slick and hot and unbearable. Ted's twisted all around, wanting more of it, wanting... God, how has he lived this long without Trent fucking into him? So slow and careful, every nerve in Ted's body singing.
Do you like this? Trent murmurs. And Ted can't think why it's funny,
but he laughs and gets his legs around Trent's narrow hips, lifting himself up just enough to make him gasp as Trent's cock hits him right there, right, perfect. He comes all over himself, and Trent's rhythm stutters as he pushes in once, twice, like he never wants to be anywhere else. Which is convenient, since Ted's not letting him go after this. Ted wakes sometime in the small hours that night, the dream he was in the middle of already slipping away. Trent's half sitting up in bed next to him, staring out the window, the moonlight streaming in like they're in some sort of noir film. They're both still naked, which is always going to look better on Trent, but Ted's breath catches at just how beautiful he is right now. The lines of his face and the way he breathes and the freckles on his arms. Artwork Ted could never have dreamed up. All for him. He must give himself away somehow, because Trent smiles a little without looking over at him, and shifts to settle his hand in Ted's hair, stroking gently.
"You know, I had to look up the term for them," Ted whispers.
He's not sure why. They were loud enough to set ears ringing before.
"Nasolabial folds. You know what those are?"
That stops the hair stroking for a minute. "What?" says Trent, staring down at him, although he's whispering too. Ted scooches a little closer, so he can trace one of the laugh lines from the corner of Trent's nose down to his mouth.
"You've got really nice ones," he says. "I just thought you should know."
"You're an utterly ridiculous man," Trent says. He clears his throat. "Listen, I should tell you, before you find out tomorrow anyway." "Oh, God, are we trending or something?" Ted says, and presses his forehead against Trent's hip. They'd clean themselves up earlier before collapsing back into bed, but Ted can still smell him under the soap, a tang and salt sweetness. "Fortunately, only locally thus far," comes Trent's very unreassuring answer. "But no, it's not about that." Ted takes one more breath before rolling onto his back, wincing a little. Anal sex is now at the top of his list for good times, but the after effects are no joke. "What's it about?" Trent looks out the window again. "I've spoken with my editors at The Independent, as well as my publisher and my agent, and we've all agreed to a leave of absence from the paper until the end of the season. I need to finish the last revisions and add that chapter on..." "What?" says Ted, trying to sit up until Trent makes an impatient noise and shifts down in bed, draping himself along Ted's side and slinging a leg over his hips to keep him in place. "You're a leave of absence? Why? Until when? Why?" "Until the end of the season," Trent repeats, propping himself up on his elbow. "And because I really do need to finish this damned book before the next FIFA scandal renders it irrelevant." Ted doesn't buy it for a second. "Rule number 2, remember?" he says, reaching up to tuck some of the hair falling into Trent's face. It's a losing battle. The man would make Mustafa jealous. "All right. Yes. Also, because I'm worried about the fallout of our relationship going public," says Trent, kissing Ted's palm absently, "although it likely won't help one way or the other, in terms of speculation about my partiality, and I'm sure Arsenal will have a great deal to say about it." "Then why bother?" Ted asks. "You love covering football. And you said yourself, all the ethics and what all of us dating, there's not a conflict if you don't cover Richmond." "There is conflict, though," Trent interrupts. "And you know it, too.
it hasn't come up yet, but next year, when you're back in the Premier League, it's not just that my coverage will be questioned, Ted. It's that I would question it. I don't want my feelings for you to impact my objectivity. Ted has to think about that for a little bit. He remembers last October, barging into Trent's office, Trent telling him that just having the hots for somebody at Richmond was a conflict of interest. Although Trent probably didn't say having the hots for somebody. But it still doesn't sit right with him. Okay, again, really loving your positive thinking in regards to our chances of getting promoted, he said. But that's next season. Are you going to be on hiatus then, too? You'll just never cover football again? Trent smiles at that. If you earn your promotion, I'll be busy writing another book, he says, tapping Ted meaningfully on the chest. And by the time that's published, I suspect you and I will be... Trent Crim, I swear to Kenny Rogers, if you end that sentence the way I think you're going to... Rather old hat, finishes Trent, still smiling. Better, Ted grumbles. He thinks about it some more. So, basically, I really need to earn this promotion and win the league title next year. Trent settles down half on top of him, making a vague affirmative noise. Okay, well, that's a lot to put on a man's plate at... He looks over at the clock on the bedside stand. 3:47 in the morning. You think I can do it? Trent hmms a little bit more and reaches up to press his thumb right between Ted's eyebrows. I think, he says, that you've got a lovely glabellar line. They fall asleep with Ted's forehead resting on the delicate knob of Trent's spine, feeling Trent's heartbeat against his chest, breathing in its rhythm. With all that buildup, Ted expects the blowback to be bad. Reporters he'd thought were his friends hounding him, strangers getting in his face, all sorts of stories running about his secret gay sex romp with Trent Crim, the Independent. It's worse. Ted moves right into the clubhouse for the better part of a week, since getting down to Brewer's Lane to his apartment is all but impossible. Will goes and packs him up a few things. When he gets back, he's got a glower on his face that almost looks intimidating, if it were somebody other than Will. Somebody asked if I was your neighbor, and then if I was your boy toy, he says, handing over the knapsack. I said, not on these wages, so I might have accidentally started a rumor that you underpay your boy toys. Trent's got the opposite problem, getting trapped in his house. Serafina's safely away with her grandparents, but I'm playing Rapunzel in the tower for now, he says when Ted calls him later. You've got the hair for it, says Ted. There's 5 vans parked on the street. I've even raided ESPN, although Harry never did like me much. Look, Trent, I'm sorry. I'm not, says Trent. This will blow over, Ted, and I'll be able to give you a proper snog in the middle of the street. That alone is well worth the inconvenience. You old romantic, you. They've got an away game down in Bournemouth on Wednesday, and thank goodness they win, because the press pool afterwards is more vicious than Ted's ever seen them. He tries telling himself that with a story like this, even Trent would probably be asking these same types of questions, but that just serves to make him mad at the fake Trent in his head. There are a few bright spots. Michelle makes extra sure that Ted gets to chat with Henry every night, and it's a lot more fun talking about second grade drama than grown-up drama. Even though Henry's still lapsing into French like English is too much trouble.
Papa,
Est-ce que Trent est ton petit ami? He asks one day. He's really cool. Je l'aime.
Oui, buddy, he is, says Ted. And that's pretty much the extent of Henry's interest. The team is the biggest surprise. The biggest good one, anyway. Coach, says Isaac a few days later, hovering in the doorway. The team got together and... We didn't buy you anything, sorry. Maybe we should have, but we got you this. And he thrusts one of those oversized birthday cards with a bright yellow envelope at Ted. Inside is a card with a very large, very glittery rainbow heart on the front, with the words, Love is Love, in similarly glittery lettering. Inside were messages from the whole team, of support, of happiness that he'd found someone. Jamie just signed his name, but added, and Ted Danson to it, which felt special somehow. Sam wrote him a wonderful message about caring for the team and caring for its leaders, which ran right into the back of the card and a couple post-it notes stuck on for good measure. You just stay strong, coach, says Isaac. Anybody messes with you, we'll rip them apart, yeah?
Yeah, Isaac, Ted says. He's holding onto the card so tight he's going to crumple it. But he can't seem to let go. By Saturday, Rebecca has to call a strategy meeting. I'll admit I'm surprised, she says, tapping her pen on her desk. It's been relatively benign so far.
This is benign? Ted asks. He believes her. If anybody knows what the press can do when they're at full throttle, it's her. But he got a Facebook message from his old high school girlfriend Patrice last night, asking if he was okay because she'd been fielding calls about Ted's prowess in bed. They even used that word. She wrote, prowess. I thought it was some kind of sex position until I looked it up.
Rebecca sighs. Unfortunately, yes. But, she says heavily, the minute we lose a game, or God forbid, tie again, they'll go right back into a feeding frenzy. Bunch of fucking pricks.
Ted looks over at Trent, who was somehow winkled out of Darnley Terrace to attend this meeting of the minds, and tells him, present company accepted, of course. Trent just lifts an eyebrow.
I'm not sure that it is, he says. It's the first time Ted's seen him in a week, and he wants to reach out for him, kiss the dark circles under his eyes.
It isn't, says Rebecca. What would be ideal is for you two to go away for a month and give the press something else to fixate on, but inconveniently for you, Ted, you've still got a job to do. We're neck and neck with Bournemouth for the top two spots, and we just beat them, but the last thing any of us need is for you to split your focus until we secure the promotion.
Higgins's phone rings just then, with a jazzy little number. Higgins looks down at the ID in some confusion, but answers it, muttering quietly at the people on the other end. Ted just hopes it's not another reporter trying to scale the fence.
We don't need a month, Keely pipes up from her spot on the sectional. The news about Mike Sands shagging Tiana's mom on the Man City bus is going to drop soon. Plus, there's the other thing you've been working on. Ted and Trent are already being portmanteaued, so once those stories hit, no one will give a shit about these two.
Excellent point. Rebecca's tapping went up a couple beats per minute.
Can we nudge either of those stories up?
Nudge them up, Trent says, leaning forward with an outraged look on his face.
Ted's distracted by the other thing Keely said. Portmanteaued? He asks, turning around to look at her. You mean like Bennifer or Brangelina? What's ours?
Tread, Keely tells him sympathetically. Honestly, that might be what dooms you two as tabloid fodder.
I feel like Tent was right there and they whiffed it, if I'm honest, Ted says, and she nods in agreement.
"Do you mean to tell me," demands Trent, glaring at Rebecca, "that you've somehow procured some scandals to use as cover for us?" Rebecca glares right back. "You're a bit long in the tooth to be this naive, Trent. How do you think you got your cozy little one-on-one interview with Ted last year, Ted looks over at Trent. "Who's got his jaw set?" Rebecca sits back and smiles, cold and phony. "It was a favor to your boss, in exchange for a favor for me. Welcome to the lifestyles of the rich and famous. I'm sure you'll learn your way around eventually." "I'm well aware of how I got that interview," says Trent, although it's closer to a snarl, "just as I'm aware of what favor was exchanged. Don't insult me by glaring at him. Of course he didn't say a word. I found out on my own. I'm a journalist, if you'll remember." It's hard to forget. The smell of high-minded hypocrisy is rather high-minded hypocrisy. "All right now, fellas," Ted starts. "Shut up, Ted," they say in unison. Ted, saved from having to hold both of them up by the scruff of their necks like a couple of ornery cats, by Higgins, who hangs up his phone. Sorry about that," he says, clearing his throat. "But there's a woman at the front gate insisting that we're holding her son hostage. She says he's to be released immediately." That at least gets Trent and Rebecca staring at him, instead of lunging over the desk to throttle each other. "And security isn't handling it?" Rebecca asks. "Well, they were," says Higgins, "until she told them her name is, Dr. Sarah Krim." "Oh, Jesus Christ," sighs Trent, pinching his nose.